Airfare.com.
I'm Christopher Ladd, and this is The Connection. Our guest, James Elkins, is part art historian, part playground kid, full-time passionate observer of the world all around him. When he goes to a museum, he doesn't just absorb the painting in front of him. He stoops down just underneath it and looks up to see the crackler, the peculiar pattern of paint cracks on it. He can be seen walking around campus at the Art Institute of Chicago with an odd pair of binoculars called Orscoptic Research Flip-Up Telescopes affixed to his glasses. I intend to use them on insects, he says, on butterflies and moths. The scales would be easily visible. I'll be able to observe spiders from a safe distance. James Elkins looks hard at periodic tables, at x-rays, at Chinese lettering, at human physiognomy, all the muscles and bones that make up a face. He looks at the varieties of sand and the colors of Egyptian scarabs. His new book is called How to Use Your Eyes. Connection listeners, do you look at the twigs on the trees or the cracks in the pavement as you walk to work? Have you ever examined your own fingerprint? Seriously. Do you know that if there are no clouds in the sky, the colors of a sunset are going to form a different pattern? Give James Elkins a call at 1-800-423-8255 or join us online at theconnection.org. James Elkins, this is an enormously entertaining and provocative book. It's sort of part of our self-improvement week. We're listening more carefully, looking more carefully. Take us on a walk and just start at the things we don't notice.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, I think this book is a kind of a hodgepodge, but it has everything in it was something that at one point or another completely mesmerized me or hypnotized me. And so there, a lot of the things in it are, the most astonishing things to me are the things that are very common. And I think maybe my favorite chapter, one that you just mentioned, is one on sunsets. I found this astonishing German book written in the 20s on the colors of the sunset. Written by a very, very serious meteorologist whose, I think, his motivation was to debunk the romantic sunset so we didn't all get all teary-eyed looking at it and actually figured out once and for all, quantify it and so on. So what he did was he studied the colors, those color sequences that happen every sunset, provided there's no clouds and provided there's no disturbance in the upper atmosphere. And it turns out he's right. You can take the chart that I have in my book and you can take it outside and you can follow the sequence of colors. And there are amazing phenomena. There's one of them called the pink glow or the salmon pink glow that happens about 20 minutes after sunset. People who spend a lot of time outdoors know this, campers and hikers and people know about this. It's when your friend turns purple. And when I was a kid, I actually knew about this without knowing about it because I had an odd game that I would play with my friends in which we'd try to read books in the forest at night and see who could read latest into the night. And the purple glow, which is a beautiful red or violet glow, it's a very ambiguous and hard to describe color, I think, because the wavelengths come from both ends of the spectrum. It will keep you reading for about 20 minutes. But I think far and away the most interesting thing to me about sunsets is that if you look in the direction away from the setting sun, right at sunset, and especially if you have a flat horizon, you'll see a very, very sharp purple band right along the horizon. And as you watch, the purple band moves up into the sky and diffuses and eventually becomes part of the twilight. And that is nothing less than the shadow of the entire Earth cast up onto the atmosphere. Mm. And it is really a stunning experience and very, very common. I saw it the very first evening after I read this book out over Lake Michigan in Chicago, where I work. And you actually get the feeling that you can feel the Earth rotating into the darkness. It's incredibly dramatic. And so something, a great example of something that everybody can see for free every day.
You remind me of something that's probably quite different. What we used to call the technicolor moment after a storm, before a sunset, when everything is suddenly in a different color. But that's a digression. Are you saying that these patterns are consistent?
They are consistent, yeah. You can't. I have a little color chart in the book, and I have a picture of that of the Earth's shadow, which is a much more dramatic thing. Some of the things are debatable, but actually, when you do this, you'll end up seeing the little invisible contour lines between the color areas, and you'll start seeing them diagrammatically, like the very serious German scientists did. So you might say it could ruin a sunset for you.
You look at all sorts of things. I mean, you look at orchard grass. How did you get onto orchard grass? I want to get to postage stamps eventually, but we got to talk about moth wings and Chinese calligraphy, stuff that's beautiful, whether you know what you're looking at or not.
Well, to start with orchard grass, I wanted to write a couple of chapters, and maybe I should say this: the book is 30-odd, very short chapters with facing pictures, so I wanted to have just a brief description of each thing. I wanted to write something on common natural, you know, objects, plants. I didn't want to write about trees because everyone has a field guide to the trees. I did write a chapter on twigs, which is how to identify trees in the wintertime by looking at them. And there you run into a very interesting phenomenon where it's the base of the stem of the leaf that's fallen off that leaves a little scar, and it looks like a little happy face, and it has little dots in it where the sap would flow, and they form a kind of Morse code, and you can decode them. But the grass chapter, I chose that because it's ubiquitous. It's all around the world in every temperate climate. And also because grass is traditionally hard to identify. And I have a little quote at the end of the chapter from Darwin who said, thank heavens I finally identified my first grass. It'll do my stomach amazing good or something like that. But at any rate, I didn't want to make this book into a serious kind of classificatory venture or anything like that. I have the five or six commonest kinds of grass. And the thing that happened to me when I was writing this is that I realized that I had actually all known about these grasses without knowing their names my whole life because I had been seeing them out of the corner of my eye. And when I started learning the names like sweet vernal grass, Timothy grass, orchard grass, I realized that they were associated in my mind, one with springtime and flowers and the other with the smell of the harvest and the hay and things like that. And so it seems to me that there's a certain kind of overlooked object which you really have always seen. You've always, without knowing it.
Hmm. Talk about postage stamps, which have always fascinated me. They are so densely programmed. They're mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. full of calculation and suggestion.
Now, postage stamps are wonderful. And I have...
And I'm not a collector either. I gather you're not.
Once upon a time, I was, yeah. And I have a photograph in there of some of the world's first postage stamps, English stamps, starting in 1840. And they very quickly ran through basically all of the design options that are still in use. The question was basically, how do you make a picture when an inch by inch square? And the most obvious thing to do is make it look like an oil painting or print in a frame, which is the first postage stamp. And then they tried making it look like a coin or an emblem against a background. And then there were some funny little symbolic schemes that they were trying where they would make a hexagon to represent sixpence and so on. That runs out very quickly. And they tried masonry metaphors and make the stamp look like stone and so on. I have in the book very far-flung examples. I have an example of an Indian stamp, which is just a blur of ink, because all that really mattered at that point was that it was in the right place in the envelope. But I think in the end, though, the thing that most interests me about stamps is that sometime in the last 20 or 25 years, people basically stopped looking carefully at stamps, or I would like to say at images in general. And I have a picture in the book which shows stamps from the 19th century and then a stamp that was done 100 years after, I think, in 1993, and as in commemoration of that early set. And if you look at the old stamp, you see a lovely little steam locomotive, and you can look as close as you possibly can, and you still don't see the engraving lines. You see the smoke and the steel of the locomotive, and lovely little picture. But if you look at the one done in 1993, which is based on the same designs, same set, you see very, very crude dots and dashes, basically. And what this means to me, since nobody seems to have complained about that particular issue, it means that people are looking in the most cursory possible fashion, holding the thing at arm's length. They recognize it as antique because they see a little curly outline on it, and that's enough for them. And this goes to the question of visual literacy, which is hotly debated these days, where I think there's...
Meaning what?
Well, there's basically two camps in this. The one camp says the 20th and the 21st century, the most visually literate period in the history of mankind. We see more images than any other culture did. We can see more images per minute than they could. We had MTV, now we have PlayStation 2, and we can really digest images and understand and interpret them in a very sophisticated way. The other camp in the visual literacy debate, which I'm more in, says, well, okay, that's true. On the other hand, the images on PlayStation 2 and so on, they're very self-similar. And what's gone is the individual image, which is difficult to see, ambiguous, complex, and demands some sort of meditation and a sense that you have to come back to it and bring more to it each time. Nowadays, we get that a little bit in oil paintings, and there are just a few people who visit their local museum to see the same painting over and over again. That's the kind of visual literacy that's basically disappeared.
What are you advocating here, beyond sort of wake up and look at things? Or is that the point?
I would be happy if, you know, I'd be happy if it was just a book about waking up and looking at things, and a lot of it is. There's also the thing that really interests me, I suppose, about especially the natural examples in the book, and half this book are things made by people and the others are made by nature, but especially the natural images. I'm fascinated by the idea that there are things in nature, like the little twigs and their leaf scars and so on, that you can decode, but that don't have a human meaning. And I'll give you the example from the butterfly wings chapter. It turns out that all butterfly and moth wings are based on a ground plan. And it's a basic ground plan. There's a wonderful scientist, Fred Nyhaut, who works at Duke University, who wrote a great book on this. And if you look at this ground plan, it's reproduced in the book, you can decode butterfly and moth wings, even very complex patterns, like the little brown moths, you know, that are always annoying people, you know, flying in your window and flying around the light and dying on the windowsill. All they're trying to do is look like a piece of bark or a piece of dirt. But in order to do that, they have tremendously complex, swirling, zigzag patterns in very subtle shades of brown. Those can be compared to this very simple plan, and you can see how evolution has, by stretching and smearing and distorting, made a thing which is which looks like just a subway map, the basic plan, into something which looks like bark. So what's fascinating to me about this is that that has no human meaning. It doesn't signal to us. It doesn't even signal to the birds that would eat the moths. In fact, on the contrary, they don't see it. And a couple of weeks ago, somebody asked me about whether I was doing what Sherlock Holmes is doing, looking at overlooked things. And it took me a while to realize I think what I'm doing is the exact opposite. Because what Sherlock Holmes does, looking at the bit of tobacco stain and the fingerprint and all that, he immediately uses them as evidence to solve some human mystery, some human crime. So he's decoding them, but he's then interpreting them as evidence of something that means something to us. What I love is just looking at these things and realizing that they don't actually say anything to us. They can say a little bit to the evolutionary biologist who studies the butterfly wings, but that's because he's using them for his human meaning and so on.
But some of them do say human things. I love your observation of the human face. There's a certain kind of anatomical lesson in it, but there's also a huge admiration of Michelangelo and Leonardo and the other classic observers of human structure and the making of art out of it, the making of human meaning.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And then the Michelangelo drawings are there because they're beautiful to look at. They're exemplary pictures of the face. But I was also interested in that chapter on the face in showing how you can look at a young face that seems to have no signs of age and see what happens when the person gets older. You can use your mirror as a time machine if you're up to it. And also, a large part of this book is putting words onto things that don't have words. So you, when you learn the words for the parts of the ear, helix, anti-helix, there's about 10 or 20 arcane words for bits of the ear. Then you start looking at people's ears. You start realizing that they're different.
Yeah. James Totter's book is called How to Use Your Eyes. I said James Totter, and I meant James Elkins. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about waking up and noticing things on The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. What do wine tasting, New England shipwrecks, and ballroom dancing have in
things? And he makes it feel such a pleasure. His book is called How to Use Your Eyes, and it does exactly that. On crystals and sand, we haven't got to geometrical drawings or human x-rays or how non-medical specialists can get a bang out of them, but we will. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Welcome, Steve. Good.
Good morning, Mr. Elkins.
Hi.
Hi. I just had a couple of comments. The first is I agree very much with Mr. Elkins about his take on visual literacy. I teach freshmen 2D and 3D design at a local university, and I think there is a big difference between seeing a lot of things and seeing things of quality deeply, and that's one of the things that they really need to learn. The other thing was, the original reason why I called was just being reminded of the experience of total eclipse of the sun when Mr. Elkins was talking about the sun setting. And it's another example of, I guess you could call it visual misdirection. I didn't look at the eclipse of the sun because I was out walking during my lunch hour and I didn't want to burn my eyes. I was looking at the ground. And it struck me the patterns that the leaves of the trees, the shadow patterns that were there. They were in double and seemingly triple and weaving in and out of one another. It's just a beautiful experience, and it's something that you wouldn't think of when you think of the total eclipse. You usually think of the phenomenon and not of the sort of byproducts of the phenomenon.
Exactly, exactly. Well, now you've tempted me, and I have to go ahead and mention this, that I have a notion about eclipses, and I'm sure that this will bring a storm of disclaimers, and I'll give you a disclaimer at the end, but I have a notion about eclipses that they don't actually make you blind. If they did, history would be full of
people. Don't try this at home.
Thank you. That was the first disclaimer. History would be full of people who had looked at the sun and gone blind. But you notice when there are eclipses that TV stations are very hard-pressed to find even one person who's had damage. I don't at all deny that you can damage your eyes looking at the sun, and I wouldn't certainly try this at home. This is not an invitation to experiment. But isn't it interesting that there aren't, for example, histories of martyrs who deliberately went blind, that there aren't children all over the world who perversely looked at the sun and went blind? It's a very interesting cultural phenomenon is what I'm saying, that there is this fear of looking right at it. And then, as you say, by making sure that the experience is so carefully modulated and so carefully veiled in the various devices that they are always telling you to use, then people miss the things like those lovely dappled shadows.
You can look at the shadows.
Yes, you can look at the shadows.
1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line.
Hi. Professor Elkins, I want to endorse what you're saying. My wife and I have just moved to this area. We live out on a little peninsula called Nahant, which is just north of Boston, and we have spectacular sunsets every night, and we're mesmerized by this rising shadow of the earth counter to the side of the sun. I just wanted to alert you to one thing. My wife's a particularly keen observer of visual phenomena. She just wrote a book on the subject called The Language of Landscape. She kind of laments the fact that culture as a whole, and designers in particular, have kind of lost an understanding of seeing what is around them. And I'll just give you two examples. When she was at another university, there was a great tree, a great flowering tree, that was right alongside a construction site. And one spring, everybody was amazed at how profuse and early the flowering of this tree was. And everyone was, you know, very self-satisfied and wondering, in wonderment about how beautiful this tree was. Mm-hmm. My wife, on the other hand, saw this as an ominous sign. This tree was was trying to propagate itself desperately as it was dying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a small observation. A bigger observation that she's been pursuing in her work is a pattern of housing abandonment in cities like Boston and Philadelphia. And what she realized was that there was early and more severe housing abandonment in areas that overlay underground streams. You're probably aware that America, you know, in urbanizing itself,
absolutely
has covered underground streams and converted them to sewers.
You know, there's a wonderful subject waiting to be explored here, and that is culverts.
Yes.
A culvert is something that's absolutely fascinating.
You've got to explain your thing about culverts.
Yes,
a culvert
would love
is an abomination.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I have another take on culverts.
Go ahead.
So a culvert, I mean, so of course a culvert is anything that directs water underneath a road, a stream, a rivulet, anything like that. And I think they're much more interesting than bridges, which are celebrated all around the world. They're great engineering feats, for sure. Some of them are beautiful. But culverts are ubiquitous, and they have an awful lot to say about the place that you live and the way that the world is slowly being paved over, because it's not an easy thing to get a stream to go under the road that everyone knows has to go right at that spot, right at that angle, without changing the course of the stream and causing erosion and things like that. And if you live closer to a city, you may never think of this because as a higher percentage of the land gets paved over, more and more water gets directed underground. And there are entire cities that are built over rivers that no one knows about, of which my favorite example is Baltimore. And the only people who know that Baltimore is over a river are crazy kayakers who try to go up and underground. So there's a lot to be seen by just stopping your car and looking at a thing like a culvert, as far as I'm concerned. And sure, there are abominations when they're built badly. I go along with that.
So, Paul, what's your knock on culverts?
My knock on culverts? Well, it's not culverts per se, but it's about what we've done with water in developed areas, as you say.
Right.
What we've done is we drain it off the surface too quickly and dump it into combined sewage systems and overflow and overwhelm our sewage treatment plants, when instead we should have some decent open space planning. This has been done in cities like Denver, for example. Where water is detained in natural areas, greenswards, and instead of being a hazard every time it rains, it provides a recreation area. Mm-hmm.
You think it would also help, as far as I'm concerned, just to see these things? Because, for example, in Chicago, you can take a tour of what they call the Deep Tunnel, which is a huge reservoir 300 feet underground. I think it's 100 feet in diameter and whatever, a couple miles long, to catch the overflow. Just seeing that makes me much more aware of the way things are happening under your feet.
Paul, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the how to use your eyes connection with James Elkins. Ed is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Ed.
And hi, James.
Hi.
I'm an oil painter. I'm using my eyes all the time. I paint outside on the spot, and I'm really struck by a lot of what James has to say. I have actually done a painting of that purple band that you were talking about at the very beginning of your show. And I bet you know this from observation, but it does happen every time it's a clear night. I always look for cold
fronts
coming down from Canada. But above that purple band are the colors of the rainbow from that band all the way directly above your head.
That's right.
Amazing thing. It happens every night.
That's right. And so what I was saying about looking at these things and starting to see the invisible lines between them, when I look at sunsets, I'm cursed because I see the little imaginary dotted lines running between all these little colors. And I want to mention one other thing that's very, very common that people overlook in the atmosphere, and that is ice halos. An ice halo, I think the commonest version of this, the thing that people notice, is if you're out in the afternoon, it's winter and it's cold, toward the horizon, usually in the afternoon, to the right and left of the sun, you'll see bits of rainbows, as if they're little scraps of colored spectrum. Mm. Those are actually the left and right parts of a circle that goes around the entire sun and is very wide. So if you look up to the sky and hold your arms outstretched at 45-degree angle, that would be the way the ice halo is.
Oh.
These are not rare. They are caused by ice crystals and cirrus clouds. They're not at all rare, but you have to basically, instead of being rushing from, you know, to cover in the wintertime, you have to stand out and look up and move your head around. And they are just spectacular. It's like, from my way of thinking of it, it's like a big eye in heaven looking down at you when you see these things.
Beautiful.
Ed, thank you. Is there more?
Oh, I have a million. I really do have a million of them. Come on in. I'm in my studio right now. Some people just came in. But two other things I thought I'd mention, James. Have you ever seen that strange green spot that happens over the sun at sunset?
The green flash. I can tell you what causes that, and I can say I wish I had seen it. The green flash is something that people who live in California and look at the sunset see eventually. It's a rare phenomenon. Right as the sun sets, an ellipse separates off the top of it and then flashes bright emerald green and then disappears and then the sun sets. It's just a fraction of a second. It's been caught in photographs, but it's rare. It's caused by two phenomena happening at the same time. First, the atmosphere has to be such that the sun's image is stretched a bit into a spectrum, so the blue is at the top and the green and the red is at the bottom. Then there has to be mirage conditions, which is something that's also I write about in the book. Mirages are very interesting and very common. So the mirage separates out the spectrum, and the green gets isolated and gives that wonderful flash.
Have you seen it, Ed?
There is a photo, I think, in Smithsonian or National Geographic in the last month or two, and I always thought it was just an illusion.
No.
Apparently it's not.
No,
it's
not
thing.
An illusion. It's real.
Yeah, people actually look for it.
Yep.
One more shot, Ed?
The last thing is noticing the earth move. Since I paint these a lot, if you look at the shadows cast by a fire escape, and you look at a brick away from the fire escape that the shadow is moving towards, and just focus on that brick, if you just look at
you might be even more obsessive than I am.
Well, I got to paint them. You know, it takes a long time to paint them, and these
go on about the brick.
All the time. But yeah, if you just do that, you'll feel the earth moving. You'll actually see shadows moving towards that brick.
And also, this makes you dizzy, by the way.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you.
Ed, you're going to try that. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 with James Elkins, who seems to see everything. Michael is on the line.
Hi, good morning. The show is really a trip, so to speak.
An eye-opener.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about a phenomenon. I travel to the Grand Canyon now and then, and I do like 5-day trips. The very first day, I feel like I'm in a postcard.
Like you're climbing the Grand Canyon right now.
What's that?
Go ahead.
So the first day, it feels like you're in a postcard, and by the fifth day, you're so aware of things around you that it's almost unbearable.
Mm.
Every little plant, every little rock face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just a really interesting phenomenon, something about it. And one other thing I wanted to mention was walk with your dog and sniff what it sniffs. And the third thing was, how many of us listen to our heartbeat?
Yeah, sometimes you can't avoid that. You know, this thing about the Grand Canyon, I love the Four Corners country, and my wife, who's from Ireland, is not a big fan of this in some ways, because you can get overkill with the colors and the things that you have to look at, and you can't stop looking at them. So there's that problem, too.
Ed, thank you. Maybe you should do the book on how to use your nose. We'll make a program out of it. How to use your dog's nose. Ed, thanks. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with James Elkins. Rosemarie is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Ed, I wanted to ask you why the colors are so much more intense and vibrant in Ireland. Dublin has air pollution now, but the colors are still that way.
There is something pretty uncanny about green in Ireland. I have to admit this, and I'm absolutely not starstruck by myths and legends, shall we say, about Ireland. But there is something about the fact that it's very lush. You really do feel like you're seeing 50 colors where you once saw one. And there are interesting exercises you can do along these lines to discriminate more and more and more greens. There's a book that's used in a lot of art schools by Josef Albers, a painter, who had it as his goal, that kind of ability. I think the limit, by the way, is 2 million colors. So once you get started on those colors in Ireland, there are no more than 2 million greens.
But Rosemary wants to know why they seem... They are astonishing.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, the reason that you look at them is, as far as I'm concerned, because you're in a, and we're talking about the very lush parts of Ireland, you're in a monochromatic environment, almost. And so you start looking very carefully to discriminate very subtly.
Some of it is the Guinness, too.
That's right. It helps.
Rosemary, thank you. Could I just ask you, I mean, the thing that's intimidating about looking in general is that you won't know what it means. I mean, for example, X-rays, or for example, Chinese calligraphy. You could look at it all day. I wouldn't, simply because I would never know what it was saying. And yet you somehow, I mean, you're encouraging people to make their own meaning, in a fashion, of things that you don't necessarily penetrate. To look at the sunset and kind of make up your own story, but let your eye lead you to some kind of wisdom or understanding.
Definitely. I mean, that
takes courage.
Yeah, although there's also a lot of... There are also cases in which you can be very quickly led astray. So in the case of X-rays, for example, I was tutored by a radiologist on how to see these things. And I am amazed by the ability of some of these people. This fellow was sitting side by side with me, shoulder to shoulder, in a dark room looking at these X-ray plates, some of which I've reproduced, other which I couldn't. And he was seeing things I absolutely could not see. And they were right in front of my eyes. Then I was inventing things, as you say. I mean, I was suggesting things to him, what this, and he's, no, not that. That doesn't exist. No, that's an illusion, right? So there are also limits that have to do with the amount of time, the sheer amount of time that you've spent looking at a particular kind of thing. It's very important to me that objects are different, that there isn't any rhyme or reason or rule that will help you to just plain see better. So looking at an X-ray is just looking at an X-ray, as far as I'm concerned, and it doesn't help you to look at other things necessarily.
I want to come back to this question of... the people, including artists, who see more than most people do. And it's not that their eyesight is better. My favorite experience of it is with a remarkable painter and construction artist named Varajan Bogosian, who goes walking in low tide in Provincetown Harbor, and he's oftentimes looking for broken pipe stems of fishermen in Provincetown, and he can see them on the bottom of the surface, where I don't know that any other human eye could. And he's got hundreds, thousands of these broken fragments, and he's made marvelous pieces out of them. But I've done it with him. He can see, you know, black pennies at the bottom of that same water. That it's spooky. It's almost as if he's on another wavelength.
Well, you know, we were talking about butterfly and moth wings, and when I was a kid and I used to collect butterflies, I used to always be looking for the little triangle shape of a moth at rest, especially the ones where they would be camouflaged. And I have never lost that ability. And in fact, sometimes I'm startled. I'm just walking down the street and I see out of the corner of my eye something that gives me a jolt of adrenaline. I turn around and I look, thinking that it's going to be some particular moth that I'm from 30 years ago, and I see a scrap of paper torn off of a billboard on a telephone pole or something like that. So these are also things that get hardwired after a while.
Do you think you've trained yourself? I mean, does having started out as an art historian and a sort of student of painting, does that translate into looking at nature, for example?
I taught once a year of geometry in University of Chicago Laboratory School, and we substitute teachers, you know, who were called in to teach that year. We were told, okay, there's going to be a parents' night, and the parents are going to say to you, why does my son or daughter have to study Euclidean geometry, and isn't this a waste of time? And you're to tell them, this is what they told us, that this is going to teach them to think. And I immediately determined to do the exact opposite, which is what I did. Parents' night came around. I did get this question. And I said to them, look, this is teaching them to think like Euclid. And it's not good for anything else. They're not going to help them in life, but they will be able to read Euclid with great pleasure.
Will they be able to see differently?
Yeah, so the same thing happens with the visual world as far as I'm concerned. And this is not a hard and fast rule, but it seems to me that the individuality of things is their most interesting property.
There's lots more to see with James Elkins. His book is called How to Use Your Eyes. Mandalas, for example. We haven't talked about Egyptian scarabs either. Give him a call at 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, a look back at famous New England shipwrecks. That's on
Blair.com.
I know you deceive me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, 'cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and
our guest is James Elkins of the Art Institute of Chicago, and he's sort of retraining our eyes to look at sand, for example, different kinds of sand, or to look at sight lines in perspective, or to look at halos in the sky. Give him a call at 1-800-423-TALK. Rishi is on the line.
Hi, Christopher.
Welcome, Rishi.
Really enjoy your show, and I just wanted to tell Mr. Elkins that I've really enjoyed his book.
Good. Thanks. Thank you.
You've been there.
And I'm calling. I'm a writer, and I guess one of the things that I'm interested in that comes up in this book is the relationship between words and images, and language and images. Mm-hmm. Remember in your section on the shoulder and looking at shoulders?
I remember,
About how there's so many more things we can see when we have the words with which to classify them as we're looking. And it's strange. I guess this question of language and the image also comes up when you're talking about rebuses and other things. And I'm wondering if you see this... as a writer, I feel like that's certainly an aspect of it, that words enable us to see, but they also, it seems to me, have a a sort of power to prevent us from seeing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful comment. It's a serious and important problem. And my basic answer to that is that there's no way around it. Language is the way that we understand things. We present them to ourselves. And I love the visual as much as anybody around. But it's necessary when you're talking about it to just put invisible labels on things. The labels have to be either actual words or invisible dotted lines, if you'd like. In other words, they have to be graphic elements you can describe. And they definitely do limit the way you see, especially in the things like the shoulder and the face. It's very hard once you have a stock of words to see things that are between those words. It's just that there's no alternative. The alternative is to, for example, I could write a picture book, right? And I would have no text. But then I'm just deferring the problem, leaving it up to the reader.
But what are you talking about in the case of the shoulder, for example? What is it you learn with words that distract your eye or block your eye?
Well, in the case of looking at the shoulder, you can learn to see where the rib cage and the shoulder blade are, and then you learn the basic muscles that go over that, and it gives you a kind of illusion of transparency, so that the very lovely and always changing forms on the shoulder as a very flexible part of the body, which is why I chose it, you can then see what's happening, as it were, in your mind's eye. Not as an X-ray. This is, going to the point of how each thing is different. But you can see them. The problem is that these words only describe, say, an entire muscle. There's no words for individual strands within it. Hmm. You can tell then, you look at the strand, you say, okay, that belongs to that muscle. But you don't have a word for that, making it very hard to see.
Rishi, a good thought. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Gary is calling from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hello. Yes, this is Gary.
Welcome, Gary.
How y'all doing?
Good.
Fine.
I teach 3D animation and computer graphics at the Memphis College of Art, and I'm also a 3D animator myself. But I found a wonderful source of textures and cool patterns using a digital camera.
Uh-huh.
And I suggest that anybody who wants to get a camera, get one with a macro function, these new electronic cameras.
What does it do you for?
I found some wondrous textures in my backyard just off the backs of toads.
The backs of toads?
Toads, right. I've never really looked at one that close up. And just they're what kind of looks like imperfections. They're warts, whatever, their oily skin and all that.
Warts, exactly.
It's amazing textures on there. And you can apply that to 3D objects in the computer and where you've got...
Exactly, texture mapping.
Texture mapping, what I'm talking about.
Yep. In fact, nobly warts are one of the stocks in trade of texture mapping.
Definitely, yeah. For dinosaurs, you can take the back of a toad and apply it to your 3D dinosaur.
This used to be called the dirty couch problem about 10 years ago on computer graphics. People could do formica and that kind of thing very easily, but they couldn't do the dirty couch. And it takes nobly warts to do a dirty couch.
Right. You apply your bump maps and your...
That's right, bump
your
mapping.
Specular maps. Mm-hmm. Another thing I've discovered with... I've got a very old microscope that was handed down from my grandfather.
Mm-hmm. So do I. Not from my grandfather.
You're
but
the same guy, I think. The two of you.
Exactly. Love those nobly warts. Yeah.
And I actually discovered this by accident. I thought, could I take my digital camera and actually put it over there without the fancy attachments that you normally need to take pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, I could. I could take pictures of, right through my microscope.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of things that I could have written about which you can see just even with a hand lens, but I didn't want to. Even sand, for example, I restrict myself to talking about things that you can see, that you can almost see. Maybe you need a little magnifying glass, but basically things you can see with the naked eye, because eye is very powerful. And I'll give you an example of something many people have known and yet not known what it was. That is floaters. If you look up into the sky or at a blank wall and you see those annoying little out-of-focus things in your eye, and you can't turn your eye to focus on them. Those of you who have seen them, who have tried to focus on them, that they're shaped a little bit like strings of pearls. And they're like beads. Each one of those beads is a red blood cell, harmlessly detached from the retina in most cases. This is not something necessarily to call your doctor about. But that means that you're looking at something incredibly tiny. Maybe one of your listeners knows how tiny a red blood cell is. I can't remember offhand, but it's the smallest thing you can see with the naked eye, and that's no lenses at all.
And why do they come and go?
Well, they're apparently detached from the retina and then they're absorbed again. So, right. But they're always close to the retina, so they're casting a shadow on it. That's what you see.
This is fascinating. Once you start looking, Gary, thank you for the call. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Kevin is on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Welcome.
Yes, Chris. Hi.
Greetings.
Listen, I just tuned in. Thanks for taking my call. Has anyone mentioned the work of the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges on the show?
You're the first man today.
Not yet.
Well, he wrote a story probably in the 30s. I know he was born in 1899, called Funes the Memorius. And it's actually a cautionary tale for your guest there.
Uh-oh.
It's a horror story about a man who is forced through circumstances, mysterious circumstances, to remember everything that passes in front of his eyes.
Mm-hmm. There's another Borges story called The Alpha, about a man who positions himself, as I remember it, on his back at the basement, at the foot of the basement stairs, and in that exact spot sees everything in the entire world, including ants in Argentina and all the rest of it.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, forgive me for trying to summarize any story by Borges, but I'd like to read just a couple of sentences of this, if you'll permit me.
Go for it, Kevin.
The protagonist, he knew by heart the forms of the southern clouds at dawn on the 30th of April, 1882, and could compare them in his memory with the mottled streaks on a book in Spanish binding he had only seen once, and with the outlines of the foam raised by an oar in the Rio Negro the night before the Quebracho uprising. And now, of course, this is an amazing concept, and I know the guy who was out there in the Grand Canyon was sort of talking about the same thing. Borges takes it so much farther, and the story is only 5 or 6 pages long. I mean, it's just unbelievably
intense.
It's
very much like The Alpha. It's the same kind of thing, and it is a curse.
Yes. Let me just skip to one more. He was, let us not forget, almost incapable of ideas of a general platonic sort. Not only was it difficult for him to comprehend that the generic symbol dog embraces so many unlike individuals of diverse size and form, it bothered him.
I'm in big trouble now.
That the dog at 314 seen from the side should have been the same name as the dog at 315 seen from the front.
Yeah. Well, let's just say there's a bit of risk involved in that. You know what I'd love to do is I'd tell you a story in return for that one, not a literary story, but this is a story about not seeing anything, and yet it has an awful lot to do with vision. Last year, I was in Kyoto in Japan, and I visited the famous Zen rock garden, Ryoanji, the one with all the postcards and so on, where they rake the sand and there's 15 stones and so on. I noticed that a couple of feet short of that, there's a table. And on the table, there's a little model of Ryoanji. And I thought, okay, that's for the tourists. But I looked more closely and I realized that the sand and the rocks were glued onto it. And it was for blind visitors to run their hands over and then be guided another 25 feet and sit in front of the rock garden. That is, to my mind, an absolutely fascinating thing, because the Zen monks, and Ryoanji is a working Zen monastery with 30 monks in residence, they don't look at the Zen garden when they're sitting there. They sit midway along the long side with their eyes closed. And it's Western scholars, as far as I can see, that keep insisting on different views and how the stones are hidden and things like that. So here's a wonderful thing about not seeing anything and yet having your imagination completely filled.
Interesting. Kevin, you're invited to call in every day with the Borges observation on whatever we're talking about. That was beautiful. 1-800-423-TALK. David is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, David.
Hiya.
I was an amateur paleontologist in high school. I attended the only high school that has a paleontology museum on its campus.
Where is that, David?
That's Webb School in California, Claremont. And one of my fellow grads is the curator of paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And I was on a trip where a group of us went out with him for a walk in the desert. And believe me, the rest of us saw nothing but sand and rocks. And my friend Malcolm went and found about a dozen different things that were all pieces of animals that lived long ago. And
that's a perfect example of, just eyes that are gifted or trained to see what nobody else sees.
Well, the museum in New York is sort of the Carnegie Hall of natural history museums, and the way he got there was practice, practice, practice.
That's right.
David, that's great. Thank you. 1-800-423-TALK. Al is on the line. We're learning how to use our eyes.
Hi. You've been talking about beach sand, and I had a really nice experience in Jamaica in Negril, and I was just sitting on the sand, and I looked, and I realized all the beach was made of shells and broken shells, but there were also whole shells in there. And I started digging around, and I came up with about five or six different specific kinds of shells, and I started arranging them by size and by type. And by color, and within a couple of days, I had a collection of hundreds of these. And they're very tiny.
Well, the sand section in my book is inspired by a gift my wife gave me. She found in an antique store a lovely set of three dark mahogany boxes, 19th-century boxes, filled with microscope slides with sand from the most exotic places, St. Helena, Antarctica, the Arabian Desert, and Utah, and some things like that. So I've had an armchair quarterback idea of the sand and around the world from that.
James Elkins, give us some homework. What are we supposed to do with
I would love
our
to tell
eyes
you,
now that we're open?
I would love to tell you the story of the world's most depressing calendar, which I have at the beginning of this book. There's a mathematician named Clifford Pickover who decided a few years ago that he wanted a calendar in his office, a universal calendar, last forever, but he didn't want to buy one. So he did something quite unusual. He estimated the number of days that he had left to live. He estimated 10,000 days. So he made himself a big sheet of paper, and he ruled it in a 100-by-100 square grid. And every day when he went in, he X'd off another day. World's most depressing calendar. Although I think, by the way, if you get to the end of it and you're still X'ing away, you'd probably be pretty happy. But so thinking about that, I wasn't originally going to put it in the book. I was thinking about it, and it occurred to me that this is the way we think, that we have an infinite number of days left to look at things like grass. So there's a calculation in the book in which I decide just how few days I have left to look at grass. That's my moral for the book for everybody.
Get busy, Connection listeners. This is a lot of fun. And once again, Connection listeners, get it. James Elkins, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
The book is called How to Use Your Eyes. If you're anywhere around Boston or Cambridge tonight, James Elkins will be speaking at 6 p.m. at the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard. You can use the seeing and continue the seeing conversation on our website at theconnection.org. We had help today from Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.